This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. At the bottom of the hour, I have a fascinating guest. This is going to be a very interesting interview with Dr. James Chip Coldren, and we're going to be talking about innovations in police enforcement, and it's fascinating. And for all you writers out there, I bet you'll want to read this book just to know about some of the things that are happening now and happening in the future. And speaking of the future, I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Stephen Kotler. Stephen, hi.
Hi.
Whoa, whoa, I tell you. Stephen's new book is called Last Tango in Cyberspace, and I'm on YouTube, so I'm also holding up the cover. A fascinating cover. It's a person with long blonde hair and a tattoo on the neck, and I have long blonde hair. I don't know if this is a guy or a gal. I don't know. I suppose in these days we don't know, but I got scared when I saw that tattoo. I said, oh, please, I don't want the day when they're going to make us all put tattoos on the back of our neck. But it is a great cover. And
thank you so much.
You know, it's funny. I first heard about you a couple of years ago because my son is at University of Wisconsin in Madison. And he said to me, and I just celebrated the fourth anniversary of Joy on Paper. So when this book came out, your book called The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. When that came out, I didn't have a radio program yet, so I couldn't interview you then. But my son had said to me, oh, this book is fantastic. You have to read it, Mom, because he's always trying to help me find new authors and new books to read. And I read it, and it's a heavy book, you know, stretch my mind, a wonderful book, and I was so happy when you wrote this new book. Again, I'll tell the name of it: Last Tango in Cyberspace. A very great name. You know, I this book just blew me away.
Oh, thank you. That's very sweet of you.
Well, you know, one of the things I was saying. The worst thing about your book is that it makes me think. I'm thinking now more than I'm noticing things that I didn't notice before after reading this book. Little things like how things feel, how things look. You build up this story. I'll let you tell my audience about it, but you just are so descriptive. That now when I pick up something, I say, what does that feel like? Leather? Is that real leather? And I look at things differently because of this book. So you have accomplished something really marvelous. When you get a reader who remembers your book after they read it and keeps, you know, ideas from the book in their mind, you've accomplished something really great.
That's really nice of you to say. I appreciate that.
Well, of course,
it's my job.
and you do it. You do it so well. And I tell you, when I started this book, it's called a techno thriller. Some people had put, cyber thriller. But it is wonderful just as a thriller. And then with all this technology into the story, is fascinating. And I'll tell you two other things that are funny about this book. When I was reading this book, I was headed for Newark. I was going to.
So you saw the United Way.
Yes, you know, I was going to. I went to New York City for some meetings, and usually I fly into JFK, but this was like the first time in 20 years that I flew into Newark. And I said, oh my goodness, this book, everything about this book is coming. You know, little things are just making me more aware of things. So. Just tell us where this book came from and where the ideas behind it.
So, I have been writing, Last Tango is my ninth book, and I've been writing over the past decade. I've written three books directly on technology: Bold, Abundant, and Tomorrowland, and then Stealing Fire, which was a couple books after Rise of Superman, sort of dealt with technology. And all of it's about accelerating technology and the change it's bringing into the world. But because those books had to make sense, I got to tell the story sequentially. I got to tell it one technology at a time, one innovation at a time. But that's not the future. The future isn't one at a time at all. It's everything at once. So I wrote this book. One of the main reasons I wrote this book is because I really wanted to know what tomorrow was going to look like. I wanted to put all of these technologies together in a world and see what it felt like and you know, tell a story in that world and get to run around and play in it. And you know, one of the main reasons is Ray Kurzweil, who's the head of engineering at Google. He heads up their artificial intelligence program. He's one of our best kind of technological prognosticators. Very, very accurate over the years with his predictions. And he says technology is moving so quickly, we're going to experience 20,000 years. That's 20,000 years of technological change over the next century. So this means we're going birth of agriculture to the Industrial Revolution twice in the next 81 years. And that's a massive amount of change in an incredibly condensed time frame. And it's very hard to explain what's coming, even to myself, going one at a time. So to get a real sense for that, the book is, it's a very radically different world, yet it's set 5 years in the future, and everything in the book exists today in a lab or someplace not America and is already being rolled out. There's, other than the kind of the central conceit in the book, which I made up a little bit, everything else is real.
And the way you write it, it really takes your breath away as you right from the beginning, and let's talk about this main character whose name is Lion Zorn. There's so many little connections in this book that really sort of made me even appreciate it more. I named both of my sons Lion. Their middle names are Lion. One is Leon, and one is Ari, which is, you know, Lion in Hebrew. So that name, it's always been so important to me. And so when I saw that your character's name is Lion Zorn, I thought, whoa, I'm going to enjoy this book.
Nice. So Lion's an M-tracker, which means he's an empathy tracker. He has a deeper and wider, his ability to feel more empathy than most people do. And his empathy, it doesn't just stretch out to all humans. It crosses the borders of species and goes into plants, animals, and ecosystem. It also goes up into, you know, robotics, AI, the kinds of questions that are being unlocked there. And more than that, he's got a wider sense of empathy, so he can kind of feel empathy at a cultural level, and he can spot cultural trends before they happen. And that turns out to be a useful skill for a certain kind of company. And Arctic Pharmaceuticals is that company, and they hire Lion to backtrack a rumor about a new drug that they think can be turned into a medicine, and it leads him into a murder mystery, which leads him into like three different overlapping global conspiracies, and it sort of goes from there.
And that's what there are so many twists and turns in this book, which really turns it into, just on its own, a fascinating thriller. I love all of the little twists and turns that you have here. And you know, we have conspiracy books a lot, but the way you've done this is really fantastic. Now let's go back to Lion. Now, empathy. Where did you? Is there such a thing? Do we have anybody yet who's specializing just in empathy?
Not that I know of, though. So, you know, in my other life, I'm the director of research for something called the Flow Research Collective, where we study the neurobiology of peak performance states of consciousness, focusing primarily on flow states. And flow states, runner's high, being in the zone, whatever you call those moments of kind of rapt attention, total absorption, you get so focused on what you're doing that everything else just disappears. So we know that access to flow over time, access to certain psychedelic substances over time, a couple other things expand empathy. And this is work that came out of the Harvard Development Project, 100 Years of Science, backing this up. So we know that there are certain states of consciousness that expand empathy. And we know we can expand our empathy, you know, way past the border of species, right? The astronauts, first astronauts on the moon, talked about the overview effect, feeling empathy for the entire planet kind of thing. So we know it's very flexible and it can go out very wide. And it's also, you know, it's a superpower. One of the things, so you notice, the book is about empathy, and what empathy does is it widens perception. When we are empathetic, we actually take in more information. We notice things we didn't notice before. I have now, every time you walk around and you touch leather, right, because of Last Tango in Cyberspace, you're now thinking, oh, this leather came from a cow, which had a mom and a dad, and cries and mourns their dead, and write all that little stuff about cows that I sort of threw in there, right? And that just, it, you know, it stops you a little bit. It makes you think a little bit more. And so that was sort of what that point was.
And you achieved it. As I said, it was so funny. The minute ever since I read this book, I really do look at things differently, and I feel things differently, and I'm more aware. I'm saying, you know, where did this come from? What you know, what went into it? And so this empathy, of course, you know, this is one of the human emotions that we need the most. We need to feel, not to, you know, so that we're not always just selfish thinking of ourselves. We need to try to always feel and understand how other people or animals are, or plants even, are feeling.
We have to, because the human brain, just by design, I won't get too technical here, but what our brain does a lot, just so we can make sense of the world and deal with the bombardment of information that's coming at us, is slot things into categories. And the easiest, the most basic category is us versus them. Is this thing like me or is it not like me? And the brain does that all the time, right? Automatically. And that's, you know, you magnify that a little bit. You put some energy behind that and suddenly you've got classism and racism and sexism and patriotism and tribalism and take your pick, right? So the way you bridge that gap has to be empathy.
Well, here in the book, of course, you talk a lot about tribalism, about different formations of people and groups into different social structures. Tell us about that. Tell us about some of some are actually real. Some of these.
Yeah, so there's two things here. The book, sort of one of the things, you know, you're looking at the book, and it's a book about, among other things, technology and rates of innovation and things along those lines. And one of the things that we know is that innovation can't happen in the center of any system. The big systems are just too stable, and they're built for safety and security. So you can't innovate very easily in the center of culture, in the center of companies, anywhere. So we innovate on the fringes. In nature, they call this niche creation, right? This is an evolutionary science. In business, we call it a skunk works, right? If you want to, when Steve Jobs wanted to build the Mac, the first app, the first Macintosh, right? He didn't build it at Apple headquarters or Macintosh headquarters. He took out a little shop behind the behind a restaurant hidden in Palo Alto, and, you know, hid all his engineers away from the body of the company, because the company is built to stifle innovation. It's built for safety and security and let's go slowly and nothing like that. In culture, we call this subculture, right? We don't innovate in the center of culture. The center of culture is built for safety and security. That's where tradition lives. We innovate in subculture. So if you want to know where is culture going, right, you have to watch subculture. And if you've been watching subculture, and the story I tell in the book is of the Pokemon subculture, which existed in southern Chile, down near Patagonia for a brief time in the early 2000s. What happened in the 90s is the internet did something crazy. It made subculture visible, right? Up to that point in time, if you were a shy, gay guy living in Parma, Ohio, there were not a ton of other people around you who were exactly like you. Hard to find them, right? Same thing if you were a punk rocker. Same thing if you were a communist. Take your pick. But suddenly the internet makes subculture visible. Everybody can find everybody. Everybody can influence everybody. And what you're getting is mashup cultures, what I call polytribes in the book, right? Subcultures that are blending global trends. So down in southern Chile, very conservative, quiet southern Chile, this subculture pops up, and they've blending like East Coast, emo-style goth haircuts with Japanese gyaru makeup with West Coast hip-hop gear and kind of edgy Brit-punk attitudes and California bisexuality, and they rebelled by wet kissing strangers on the street, which was insane, right? They would literally like run up to elderly men and women and grab them and shove their tongues into their mouths, and this so freaked out the government that the government basically unleashed white supremacist gangs on them and stomped them out. Gone. They were like, they existed for a very brief pocket in time. They were this poly-tribe culture, and then they were gone. And it's two things are interesting to me. Like, you got this global mashup, and then it was one of the very first times in history I've ever seen a government effectively stamp out a subculture, which was really and used basically hate speech to do it, right? Which was really wild. So we're getting really unusual alliances. We're getting really unusual blends, and more this is happening. And it's going to massively change culture, right? America, think about America as kind of a polyglot culture, but we were, you know, we weren't that wide of a blend for a very long time. Now the blend is getting gigantic. It's global. So that's interesting.
Well, it's fascinating. I had never heard about these people in Patagonia.
I was in Patagonia. I mean, I literally, like, I was, like, on the street, and I saw one of them rush across the street and grab an old woman and kiss them. And it was a girl. It was, like, a 14-year-old girl who did this to, like, a 70-year-old woman. And I went, oh, my God, what the hell was that? I'd never seen anything like it. The woman's screaming. The kids are laughing. I was like, what the hell is going on down here?
Well, I'm very glad. I'm sorry, but I'm glad they didn't move to Florida. Oh, that's all. I would freak out. And it's funny, again, talking about my youngest son, the one who's now a very serious, he's getting his PhD in biomedical engineering up there in Madison. He was a Pokemon fanatic when he was young, you know, all the kids were. But thank God he never went that far because,
You know, Madison's my alma mater. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah, I do. That's why I mentioned it. I thought, well, you know, my son loves it there.
It's an amazing place.
And he's doing his biomedical engineering. He's got a little while longer, and I'll be able to call him a doctor. But it's a wonderful place. And of course, the first year, we live in Florida. We're from Florida, and the first year that he moved there, he called me.
I'm laughing because I had a roommate from California who made it till October and dropped out because he was like, it is so damn cold here, I'm going to Stanford. And he dropped out and moved to California, back to California.
Well, my son called me after the first snowstorm, and he said, first of all, he was in a building with three floors, two were girls who seemed to not understand what a shovel was. I mean, they were like complete. He said to me, where's women's lib when you need it? They don't know what the shovel does. And so he took the shovel, and then he calls me and he says, Mom, snow is really heavy.
Yeah, that's the other thing you learn pretty fast.
I thought that was so funny because I'm actually from northern Michigan, so I grew up in the snow.
Oh, you grew up in it, and you remember the winters. I remember.
Yeah. And the wonderful thing, I remember nature. And you talk in here about how people are so disconnected from nature now. And I spent my whole childhood just in nature, just running wild, you know, with peanut butter jelly sandwich and Kool-Aid and just running wild all summer long. And people not understanding anymore. There's in these cubicles and they don't have this love of nature that those of us who had that, you know, you fear in a way for the future generations.
Well, if there's a point, but I mean, besides the, you know, wanting to show people the world, the point behind Last Tango, I think, though I try very hard not to moralize anywhere on the book, it's meant to be fun, but it's, you know, it's an argument for empathy for all, meaning plants, animals, and ecosystems, and the reason is really simple, right? There's 50 years of eco-psychology, which is the study of how we perceive the natural world, that says, look, exactly like you just said, if you live in boxes, you stare at screens, the brain takes in so much information, it starts to filter out what's not relevant, what doesn't really matter, what isn't threatening your life, safety and security kind of stuff. And it literally starts to filter out the natural world, and you literally stop seeing it. You stop perceiving it, because the brain has to filter so much information. Stuff that's not critical essentially disappears for all intents and purposes. So one of the reasons a lot of psychologists will tell you we're in the middle of a giant environmental crisis is because most people don't even see, don't actually notice the very thing we're trying to save. And the way you bridge that gap, the way you unlock perception, right, and notice what you're not noticing is through empathy. And so the only way, you know, a lot of very, very smart scientists think that we save the natural world is through perceiving the natural world, which means we have to learn to empathize with plants, animals, and ecosystems as much as we empathize with other people.
Well, Stephen Kuttler, you have written, I think, a fantastic book. It's called Last Tango in Cyberspace. And I want to tell you, I don't have very much time left, but I would like you to come back in a month or so when I get my schedule organized, and I want to talk about the rise of Superman, decoding the science of ultimate human performance, because my son, as I said, my son loved it and encouraged me to read it. I didn't quite understand everything because it's a very deep book, but I love it, and I'd like to invite you to come back and we'll talk about that, and we'll still talk about Last Tango, because I think everybody, it's available wherever books are sold. And do you have a website you want people to go to?
Yeah, feel free to check out StephenKotler.com, StevenKotler.com.
Okay, everybody do that, because Stephen is a New York Times bestselling author. The new book, Last Tango in Cyberspace, is terrific. And Stephen is going to come back on in a month or so, and we're going to talk about this book and his other books. Okay, Stephen?
Thanks, Patsy. I'd love to.
Okay, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye now. We'll go to commercial, and then I'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy Muzzi, and I am back, and I am just waiting for a call in from it's going to be fun. I'm waiting for a call-in, and I believe that we have a little problem because I think they're calling the wrong number. So I have to get a hold of them and tell them to call the right number. Okay. Okay, we got the right number now. Oh boy, these all excitement. Anyway, I'm going to be talking to somebody about something absolutely fascinating. And for all of you authors out there, this is a subject that you're going to really want to know about. It's so exciting. Okay, I am so happy to welcome to the program Dr. James Chip Coldren. Hi.
Good morning.
Okay, can I call you Chip?
Yes, please do.
Okay, I love the name Chip. My first boyfriend, when I was 4 years old, his name was Chip.
And so, a very handsome man.
Oh, a sweetheart. Absolutely adorable. And I'm sure you are, too. Boy, but we're talking about a really important subject here. And I was so thrilled when they contacted me, because this is a subject that, you know, policing in general is so important. And you are, of course, the project director for a group called Strategies for Innovation. And I want to hear about some of the things that you are working on in the entire range of using technology and data to fight crime.
Well, thank you, and I'm happy to do that. This report that we produced discusses actually 10 years of important innovative work in American policing, and this is work that has been evaluated independently, and we have found that these innovations in American policing have produced solid, significant benefits in terms of community safety and public safety. So the main thing that we're talking about is innovation, and we realize that innovation is critical for any organization to survive, especially a public organization like a police agency that works in very dynamic social and political environments. And if they're not constantly reanalyzing the problems that they confront and rethinking about approaches to resolving them, they will very quickly get stale. So it's this innovation that we think is extremely important. And hand in hand with that innovation comes, the research and the collection of data. But the interesting thing about that is that working with researchers and studying in great detail what police are doing in terms of innovation actually makes them more transparent. So it serves a great public education function in that the public can now has a better understanding about what police are doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing the things that they do. And this transparency actually contributes to strong police community collaborations. Those collaborations result in better accountability for police agencies, because through collaboration, mutual expectations are developed between police and communities, and those mutual expectations create these mutual accountability systems. So not only are the police being more transparent in what they're doing, but they're being held to task and held more accountable by the communities that they serve. So that's in a nutshell what this innovation work is all about.
So you took quite a number of years to do the research and to put all the data together. Now, you came out with some core principles of how to reduce crime?
Well, yes. There's maybe two or three things I could say here. But the most important thing is that through research and through the analysis of crime data and other sources of data, police are becoming much more adept at identifying the few places and the few people in a community that are causing the most crime and the most public harm. And it's not so much the case anymore that police will identify a crime problem and saturate a community with all kinds of police resources and basically stop everything that moves, as they used to say. With this technology and with this new approach to analysis, they're able, in almost any community, to identify those few people and those few places that are causing the most harm. So the police agency is able to manage its time and its energy and its resources much more efficiently by sending them to the places that need them the most.
Well, what are some examples? Because, I mean, we've heard recently San Francisco, for example, has stopped facial recognition. Was that ever part of your game plan of how to how to just identify people who might cause problems in the community?
We have not been working with facial recognition so much. We work with more traditional sources of information. But let's take, for example, a problem of gun violence. So it's all well and good to look at violent crimes and analyze them and figure out, you know, who's doing the shooting or if there's a shooting, where there's going to be a retaliation so police can, you know, quickly get to those people in those places and stop future violence. But one of the innovative things that's happened is that police have increasingly turned to hospitals and trauma centers to collect information on violent crime and shootings. And so they learn much more about the nature and extent of that problem by going to a different source of information like that. And that helps them, again, focus their attention where it needs to be the most.
And by going to, for example, hospitals, they can also identify patterns of people who are involved in violence?
Yes, they can, because, you know, as you can imagine, and not every instance of a shooting will the victim willingly go to a police officer and say, I need help, because they themselves are involved in the violence that's happening. So they don't. And so a lot of gun violence and shootings don't get reported to the police. And so basically the police are working with an incomplete picture of the nature and extent of the problem, and that will result in some erroneous approaches to resolving the problem. Once they get more and better information from these trauma centers, they're in a much better position to understand and deal with the problem.
Well, now, how can people find out more about your program and what you're doing?
Yes, so there's a website, www.cna.org. If people go there and scroll about halfway down that page, they'll find a link to this report. And on Twitter, they can go to hashtag SPI, the number 10, to get more information.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Chip, for being on the program today, because I think this is something, as you know, I interview a lot of authors, and this is something that I think they will want to take into consideration when they are writing their books and trying to understand the psychology of violence and the psychology of, you know, also what the police are doing out there. And I think it's a great news just for us to hear that the police are cooperating more with each other, sharing intelligence, because, you know, we're a country where people move around, and it's so important that police from one city to another cooperate and work together.
Absolutely. Yep. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today on Joy on Paper, Chip. As I said, I just love saying that name. So thank you. And it's, again, Dr. James Chip Coldren. And I think the report's fascinating.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Okay. Whoa. It is interesting. I didn't know some of these innovations that they are putting together here in the whole police community. And it was funny. I got this report. I got this report before everybody else, because they let me read it before the rest of the world. So it's really in a fascinating thing. And increasing local crime analysis is something. If as a writer, you know, you're always interested in what's happening and how police are working together, and some of the innovations are fascinating. I just, as I was reading the report, it's a nice long report, and it has illustrations, and it has lots of discussion about different things that they're doing. I, as I'm reading, I'm thinking, if I was writing a book about a murder mystery or a crime thriller, I would want to know this information. And so, as he said, you can go and see it, and it's a fascinating book. Okay, well, I've been having so much fun these past few days, but I do want to go back for a minute to Last Tango in Cyberspace. One of the things that I just loved about this book, and you know, sometimes when you authors out there are thinking about your first few pages of a book, they are so vital. And it was funny when I was reading this book, and I said to myself, you know, it's in the book, the main character is going to Newark, and I was just at Newark Airport. Wow. It was also, it was very funny. It was my first time through the Lincoln Tunnel. And I tell you, that was scary. I didn't like the Lincoln Tunnel when I went in. It's smaller than it looks like in the movies. You know, you see it in the movies all the time, and it looks wide and big, and it's actually a scary little stinky tunnel. And I did not enjoy going in that tunnel. And it, we were like in there for an hour because I arrived just after what I thought was after rush hour, at 10 o'clock in the morning. I thought, well, rush hour is done. I'm going to just zip into New York City. It's going to be real easy. But I guess there's never a time in New York City when it's not a rush hour. And so at 10 o'clock in the morning, we were in that ridiculously long tunnel. I think it's almost 2 miles long, for an hour. And it was so smelly. It was so terrible. I do not know how people can commute from New Jersey to New York City every day. I would go crazy if I had to be in that tunnel. Because it was very funny. On the way out, when I left New York City, I didn't realize I was really very, very lucky that it was the day that the president flew from Washington, D.C. to New York. And, of course, when that happens, they close all the streets. I mean, they're like, everything was a mess. But we had this absolutely wonderful driver who drove. So he was a little bit crazy, but he knew what he was doing. We got to the tunnel, and the roads were closed all over. I don't know how he got in that tunnel, but we got in the Lincoln Tunnel, and there was nobody in the tunnel. He had that tunnel to himself. And he put his foot down on that gas. He said it never happened to him. In 22 years of driving in New York City, he was never in the Lincoln Tunnel alone. There were no cars. And he did that tunnel. It's like, as I said, 2 miles long. And he did it like a minute and a half. He was so excited. I think it was one of the most thrilling days of his life to be in the Lincoln Tunnel by himself. And so he was just having a great old time, and we zipped through that. So I was so, so happy, because the thought of, actually I had been feeling a little claustrophobic before we left the hotel. I was actually scared. I was thinking, I don't think I can take an hour in that tunnel again. And that we drove through it in a minute and a half was quite amazing. So I was very thrilled with that. And so that was part of my trip to New York. I'm going to write about it. I'll put it up on my website once I finish writing this weekend, because it was a very interesting trip. And I'm very grateful to everyone, particularly everyone at the Algonquin Hotel, where I set up my office there. I'm going to do a book buzz for a very special friend and one of my favorite writers, Tasha Alexander. And we'll do a book buzz. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about a couple other things. So let's do the book buzz. Okay?
This is Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest book buzz mystery. Uneasy Lies the Crown, a Lady Emily mystery by New York Times bestselling author of smart historical fiction, Tasha Alexander. Here's the buzz. In Uneasy Lies the Crown, Lady Emily and her husband Colin must stop a serial killer whose sights may be set on the new king, Edward VII. The year is 1901, and the death of Britain's longest reigning monarch has sent the entire British Empire into mourning. This long, delightful series featuring Lady Emily Hargreaves continues with lush detail, beautiful surroundings, sparkling personalities, and the great mystery readers have come to expect. The Victorian details are engaging. Aging. Secondary characters are wildly entertaining. So grab a cup of tea and a scone and sit in your favorite easy chair and enjoy Uneasy Lies the Crown by New York Times bestselling author Tasha Alexander.
Okay, well, I was so happy to do that again for Tasha. Her books are fantastic. I really love them, and I hope that if you're interested in starting a cozy mystery, you can series start right at the beginning. And it's, of course, it's all based in England, which I love mystery stories based in England in general. And hers are particularly fun because she does a great deal of research. And you know, when you're you want to learn history. Sometimes, you know, in school, they manage to make us all sort of depressed in school. They don't teach history right. The best way to learn history is from reading novels. And particularly, you know, I learn so much of my knowledge of British history and world history in general from reading novels. But if you want to, particularly if you want to learn about the kings and the queens and the royal families, it is so much fun to read cozy mysteries that are set in England, because the authors are really people who love royalty. And so they do their research and they blend it in with fun stories. And I find Tasha's particularly enjoyable because she covers the history of England, you know, all the way back to the 1400s. And so it's just wonderful the way she blends it in. When you finish her series, you know so much about history. You know about the different royal families, you know, and all of it is just sort of just comes gradually to you as you're reading a really fun mystery about Lady Emily, who is one of those women who ahead of her time, perhaps, or not ahead of her time, because, you know, women are always and have always been strong. And so it's fun to read the Lady Emily, because Lady Emily is a strong woman, a very intelligent woman, and she gets herself involved in a lot of adventures. And all of them are fun, and many of them, not only in England, but they take her to other countries, Turkey, Italy, France, Germany, Austria, and always, again, because Tasha Alexander is one of those, her background is medieval history. She was a medieval history major, and so she puts research into her books that, of course, you know, all authors writing about history work hard to try to get the history right, and Tasha is particularly good at it because, as I said, I know British history quite well, having lived in England myself and being, you know, involved. And in fact, I've been to, it's funny, you know, when I read Tasha's books, because she is very descriptive, I have been to so many of the locations in her books, so it's great. And if you are planning a trip to England, one of the things is to read a series like Tasha's before you go, because then you'll have just enough knowledge, a little background into the characters. And so then when you do the tours, when you go to the Tower of London, or when you go to Windsor Castle, or when you go to one of the other areas of England, you already know something about it. You already know a little bit about the kings and the queens and the royal families and some of the scandalous stuff. Of course, that's always a fun part in these books, and Tasha certainly gives us plenty of that. So I cannot tell you how strongly I recommend that if you want to study history, find novels based around the period of time that you're interested. Whether it's Napoleon, you'll find lots of books set around Napoleon, or it doesn't matter. There will be books, because authors are always interested in finding historical characters that they can write about. And so there are lots of books out there. And I think it's about half of high school is a waste of time, if you ask me, when they should actually be giving the kids, say, here's, you know, sit outside, sit under a tree, supply a lot of benches and nice seating outside for good weather, or inside have a nice study reading room where people can just sit and read novels, because, you know, you learn a lot and then you really appreciate history. So I hope that you will read Tasha's books. I think they're wonderful, and you will learn a lot. Now, one other thing, I just want to, again, I just got, you know, I get books all the time, and it's so much fun. I just love, I get all these books, and I have a new mailman, and he's surprised, he didn't know that I had a radio program, and he asked me, why, you know, I I'm getting so many of these books. And so then I explained to him, yes, I have a radio program. That's why you have to lug these. But I just got a new book, and it's by Rachel Renee Russell. And she is one of my favorite authors. She writes just wonderful young adult books that kids will relate to. And the new book is This Misadventures of Max Crumbly, Masters of Mischief. And I what I love about these books is they're just filled with illustrations, wonderful illustrations. And they're written, the typeset is large and easy for kids to read. And the stories are wonderful. And Rachel, she's been on the program before, and I just love talking to her. And I know that it's going to be fun. I'm going to have her on in the first week of June. So I'm looking forward again to talking to her about her wonderful books. And they are, as I said, the illustrations are just fun to look at and tell a wonderful story. Now, I've got some nice emails from people while I was away. One of the things I want to say is that for your questions for our Legal Eagle, Bill Larson, he's going to be here on June 20th, and he will answer your questions. And it was funny, when I was in New York, I was talking to an author who, as a matter of fact, on the day that I was talking to him, was on his way to his lawyer, because he feels that someone in Hollywood, and this happens even to famous authors, they are using parts of his book. Now, they didn't steal the entire book, because then that would be an easy lawsuit. But he feels that, from what he's discovered, that they are using vast sections of his book, and just changing the name of the characters. And he was on his way. I met him at breakfast time. He stopped by we had coffee together. And then at 11 o'clock, he had an appointment with his lawyer in New York City. You know, lawyers in New York City charge about $1,000 an hour. So that's why when you get free advice here from Bill Larson right here on Joy on Paper, because he is our legal eagle and he will answer your legal questions, you should be feel very fortunate, because this writer in New York was headed for $1,000 an hour lawyer to ask if he had a case, a potential case against the company in Hollywood that is using parts of his book. And he discovered this actually from like the third screenwriter on the script, who recognized his writing and his storyline. So, you know, sometimes it's nice to have friends who are in the right places. So perhaps they are going to be able to, he's going to be able to sue, because, you know, but in the end, suing sounds nice, but even if you get a large settlement, the lawyers get most of it, so it's not really great. So that's why it's important to protect your intellectual property, to make sure when you send it out, to whom you are sending out, that you have records, that you have contracts, that you never, ever send anything. Do not ever, please do not ever send anything on the internet to somebody who says, we will write a script for you. He didn't do that, but it was somehow somebody had taken his book and obviously liked it and wanted to use parts of it. And these things happen. So it's very important that you protect your intellectual property and that you do everything right. And so that's why you should listen to Joy on Paper and listen to Bill Larson, who gives us always good advice on how to protect our intellectual property. And I wish I had known him myself when I was in my 20s, and I would have not made the mistakes that I made. And so, you know, that's why we do need lawyers, but we do need them up front before we get ourselves into a mess. Because once you get yourself into a mess, lawsuits are not fun, I can tell you that. Okay, again, I wanted also to tell everyone, go to Publishers Weekly if you're looking for an agent. And there are lots of different things happening during the summer, workshops. And if you're interested, you want to find an agent and you're thinking, I want to go to a workshop. Well, what you don't want to go to a workshop where the agents are like, you know, 70 years old and they haven't had a client. They're just teaching you about writing a query letter. You want to go where an agent is actually active. If you want an active agent, you have to go to Publishers Weekly. Look under deals, book deals, and then check the agent and Google the name and see if they are doing a workshop this summer. That's the way to meet an active agent, somebody who is getting book deals. And there are agents out there, and I met one who recently got a seven-figure deal for her author. So, oh boy, that's a wonderful thing to happen, and it's up to you to do the research, because you cannot use those ABC dictionary of agents. I just want to tell you, don't waste your money on those. It doesn't work. You need to go to Publishers Weekly, and you can subscribe. It's wonderful to subscribe because you learn a lot just from reading that magazine. It's weekly. You read it every week, and you know what's happening in the industry. You know what kind of books they're looking for. You know what, you start to recognize some of the names, and you never know if you go to a workshop or a convention. These people will be there, and you can meet them, and you can say, oh, I read your article in Publishers Weekly. That opens the door. You always are looking for ways to get into a conversation with somebody. Just like if you heard an interview here on Joy on Paper. If I interview an agent, when you contact that agent, say, listen, I heard you on Joy on Paper. You sound like the kind of agent who should represent me, and then go on from there. But it opens the door. Agents are human. I know sometimes people, you know, when they get rejected 25 million times, they start thinking agents are beasts or something, or monsters. But agents are human, and they love to be have this personal connection. They want you to be interested in them as much as you want them to be interested in you. This is what I discovered when I was in New York. Agents are really human, and they really are, you know, they work hard. They get 10 submissions a day at least, and they're overwhelmed. And that's why if you want to stand out, you have to have that little bit of extra knowledge. So, meanwhile, remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, one day to hear those words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a film, a streaming video, or maybe a television series. You never know, and you won't know unless you start writing, just like Eugenia West, who's 96 years old, is still writing and having fun, and you can have fun too. All you have to do is start and do a page a day, woo, and you'll be a happy person, and find the joy on paper. And also, make sure that you say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you so much, Ed. And he's saluting me. I'm saluting him. And everybody, have absolutely fantastic weekend. And get this book, Last Tango in Cyberspace. I really enjoyed this book. Okay, bye-bye now.